Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and as well as hosting the show, I'm the founder of the UK charity of the same name, Yes to Life, that helps people with cancer find out about the potential of integrative medicine to help them. You can find out all about the work of Yes to Life at yestolife.org.uk. My guest on the show today is an inspirational woman who's been on the show once before some years ago, but who is now working with an organisation called the Leanne Perreau Foundation, working to support women from the BAME community who are unfortunate enough to have a diagnosis of cancer. I want to find out more about the foundation, so I'm speaking to Charlotte Kroll over the internet. Hi Charlotte, lovely to be talking to you again 4 years after you were last on the Yes to Life show.
Hello, it's so good to be talking to you, and boy, things have changed so much.
Well, we're going to hear all about it. When we last spoke, we had a really inspiring chat. I actually went back and listened to a little bit of it again. I thought, wow, what a great show. You were running your own not-for-profit then, Pure Helps to Cure, a very snappy title. And that was prompted by what you'd learnt coming to terms with your own diagnosis of cancer. Lymphoma, is that right?
Lymphoma.
Yeah, and you were really young, weren't you, when that happened? You were like a teenager.
Yes, I was 17 when I was diagnosed, so yes, and I'm now 31, so many years later.
Yeah, nearly double the age. I think it would help to give a bit of context to our chat if you could summarise the intense story of your diagnosis, the treatment and recovery. Would you just tell us the story?
Yeah, sure. So I was diagnosed in 2007. After finding a lump under my arm, in the summer of 2007, I went to a doctor's appointment. I was told it was just my arm spray that caused the lump, and then I went away, and then I went back a few months later because I had nodules in my neck, and I was then told and sent for a biopsy because the doctor was worried. Upon getting my results from the biopsy, I was told I had stage 3 lymphoblastic lymphoma, and I underwent treatment at a teenage cancer unit in Houston. During that time, I had a very rough time with the medicine that I was on. So first of all, I was on a high dose of steroids, and it caused me to have something called steroid-induced psychosis, which is basically where I'm not thinking properly for myself. It's like I have a split personality living in my head. And it was really tough mentally. Yeah. And then when we finally managed to get the right balance of medication to help that kind of subside, I thought I was on the straight and narrow. And then just 2 weeks before my 18th birthday, I had a chemotherapy drug and had an extremely rare side effect, which caused my whole body to shut down within the space of 3 to 4 hours. I couldn't walk, I couldn't talk, I couldn't even swallow.
Story. So intense. Scary.
Yeah, very intense, very scary. And initially I carried on with the treatment, but it was really stopping me from being able to get my mobility back after being told that I probably wouldn't get it back or be able to speak because I hadn't seen something like this. And after doing chemo, I think for nearly like 2 years, I was on chemotherapy. I actually stopped it early and went on a holistic journey. Just like changing my whole lifestyle, environment, diet, mindset, every aspect that you can think of. I literally just tried to like clean things up and change things to help better me. And I was told in April 2010 that I was cancer free.
Yeah. Well, amazing result. And of course, it's brilliant. And this is what prompted you to start Pure Helps to Cure. I think it's because you realised what you could do yourself.
Yes. And I started doing that where I was blocking and stuff like that. And I wrote my own book, Cancer, the Hidden Truth.
Yes.
And from all of that, actually dissolved Pure Health Secure. And I have something else coming out because the word had the word cure there. You can get in trouble when you're doing things to do with holistic health and you use the word cure.
It's true.
So I'm currently setting up a holistic wellness app called Remedesk. So, yeah.
Right.
But aside from that, one of the reasons we're here is obviously to talk about the amazing Liam Pero Foundation.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, fantastic. So, well, just to let everybody know that the talk we had about the full talk about you and your journey and setting up Pure Help Secure is still there available, along with the 300 plus back editions of the show. If you just go to Yes to Life website, which is yestolife.org.uk, click the link to the show page that's on the homepage there. And but it search for you by name, and your previous interview will come up. So fast forward now to today, and you're working with the Liam Pero Foundation. So I had the pleasure of hearing Leanne speak alongside Saima Thompson. I think it was probably 2019 about the inequalities facing people from ethnic minority groups. That run right through cancer, really. Incidence, diagnosis, treatment, recovery. Leanne set up the foundation following her own diagnosis of cancer and also following the Black Women Rising campaign, which she was instrumental in. So I wonder if you'd tell us a bit about Leanne, about Black Women Rising, and about the impetus behind the establishment of the Liam Pero Foundation.
Okay, great. So Leanne went through cancer at the age of 30. She went through breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And while she was going through that, she noticed a lack of services being available to the BAME community and a lack of our stories basically being shared and basically blocked from the media. And because of that, she decided to do something about this because even before creating the Liam Pero Foundation, Liam was already like a multi-award-winning community champion with her other businesses. So she has a background in starting up things to help the community.
Right. Okay.
And everything basically first started with a luncheon, which was where she got some women together for her first year cancer-free. And just women who had gone through cancer, just talking and, you know, sharing their experiences. And from there, she actually started a support group, which was very small, and it was in Peckham in South London.
Okay.
And from that, you know, she really saw the need that we as women kind of had been missing whilst going through this journey.
Mm.
And she set up the Liam Pero Foundation, which is a charity that's offering vital help, information, and practical advice, primarily for people of colour who are cancer patients or survivors. As a charity, we strongly feel no one has to suffer in silence or feel isolated when faced with their personal cancer journey.
Right.
And from setting this up, there's been like many things that we have done as well. And the first event that we did do was the UK's first all-black cancer portrait exhibition, which has toured London, South Bank and the Oxley Tower. This shared the photo of, I think it's 11 women who were showing their scars that had got from surgery or going through cancer. And these ladies would share their stories. And me and Liam were both also a part of this exhibition. And this really got great press coverage and really kind of got people talking about cancer within the community, which is basically never done.
No.
So, yeah.
Well, interesting. I mean, I imagine there's, like, you must have had some aims for this event that you were hoping to achieve, and then probably some other things happened you weren't expecting as well. Do you want to just say what the plan was, what you were hoping to achieve with it?
So the plan and the aims was mainly to get the community to start talking about cancer, because it had become such a taboo subject and there was a lot of myths surrounding cancer and what it meant. Those people saying things like, oh, black people don't get cancer, or you don't get cancer at a certain age, or even people saying you can just pray away. So it was a space where these women could come, these real women could come, share their real life stories and really let people start opening up again, you know, really start the conversation. That was the main aim of having the exhibition, as well as also liberating these women to share their scars and their journey. And it's almost like an emotional healing process.
So can I ask, you were saying like there were these kind of stories, if you like, which were basically not true, which circulated. You're talking about within the BAME community there, but do they also apply to people outside the BAME community, actually think that about black people, that they don't get cancer so often? Or?
As far as I know, it's mainly stories within the actual community, because of, you know, when you look at a lot of the media, you never really saw black people shown in adverts for a long time, or even on TV speaking about things. No. And within our community, it's a thing of where you got cancer, you kind of kept it to yourself, or maybe just to your media family. Mm-hmm. So others didn't really know what you're going through. Right. So my knowledge is more to do with knowing what kind of the people are going through within the community, rather than how others saw us.
Right. Well, within my lifetime, obviously, cancer was the same with everybody in this country. Yeah. Nobody spoke about it. Nobody admitted they got it. And, you know, within my lifetime, the first sort of public figure to ever admit they had cancer publicly, that happened within my memory. So it's a big change. And, hugely important, of course. I mean, it's still an ongoing process for everybody. I mean, if you look, you know, women are way further ahead than men on this. Men still tend not to talk about it, or, you know, not to want to know much about it and everything. But that is changing now. And a lot of men are now prepared to be quite open about the fact they've got prostate cancer or whatever, and to want to talk to other people about it, which is great, because it's, I mean, cancer's isolating enough as it is without loads of kind of myths and everything else compounding the situation.
100%.
Yeah. So I'd like to dig in a little bit to the sort of key issues that are facing ethnic minority groups, particularly black people, because I think there is probably not very much awareness around this generally. That's my feeling. And maybe just start with some actual basics, like the incidence of cancer within black people. And I understand that some cancers are actually far more common in black people than other people. Is that true?
To my knowledge, yes. So, you know, I know you hear that a lot with prostate cancer.
I've heard that,
being more common. I don't have the figures on breast cancer, but I know in our community it's a massive. Most of the women that we have coming to us do have breast cancer. Mm. I couldn't quote a figure because it wouldn't be true.
Right. There were two sort of kind of headlines that I've heard. Yeah, one is that, twice as many men get prostate cancer. I mean, that's massive.
Yeah.
It's a huge figure because, of course, prostate's already one of the top cancers amongst men. But with women, I heard that it was a case of they were more likely to die from breast cancer. And that must be a complex story. There must be a lot of things playing into that terrible result. Social, medical, all sorts of issues that could be compounding that situation and leading to such a terrible result. I'm wondering how much is known about what the factors are that are contributing, because I mean you've described one there, which is the social issues, which is obviously a major thing, because it can lead somebody to not get diagnosed, for example, because they feel shame about having cancer or something, or that they might have cancer, and they don't get diagnosed as a result. I mean that's a terrible blow to one's treatment prospects straight away. Are there other things that are known about, the issues that are driving this?
So with the, we also have a Black Men Rising project as well.
Oh, do you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's very small because of, just like you said, it is a thing where the men don't come forward as much as, I know it's open as women, but we did have a podcast series.
Great.
Where we had Black men, and one of the things that come up was actually the initial testing that the men have to go for.
Yeah,
a lot of them don't go for or want that test just because of a lot of stigma surrounding that. The test you gotta get for the prostate,
right?
That's one of the biggest issues. People actually just ignoring the signs and symptoms as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also the factor of where people aren't speaking up, they may feel like scared to actually go to the doctors because it's such an unknown thing, something that they are only seeing on the TV mainly, not people who look like them, so they think, oh, can't be me.
Right.
And not going forward to get the test and stuff like that. So a lot of that does come from, you know, not seeing themselves reflected in the media. And then also, like I said again, people not speaking up within the community. Mm. And we've seen a big shift in this ever since the project has been launched, because so many people have now come forward and are more open and aware to going to get testing and checked. I know there was a guy, Errol McKenna, who did the whole prostate cancer campaign thing because of he had prostate cancer, and then he used to speak to the gentleman who came into his garage about prostate cancer, and I think he said about 44 of those men that he spoke to actually ended up being tested for having prostate cancer.
Mm, right, he's doing a good job. I'm very interested to hear there is a similar movement for the men. Maybe I can get them on here and make more men aware of it. That's brilliant. Is there anything known then about things like lifestyle differences, between the BAME community and other people, which might be driving the incidence of cancer forward?
So one of the things is obviously we are not in what I would say is our original environment, because a lot of the people, for instance, a lot of Caribbean people, a lot of people come over in the Windrush generation, people leaving their natural environment. This can have obviously a big effect because of you're no longer eating the way that you were when you were back home. Change your diet, change your scenery. All of these things, even the mental stress as well, being in a different environment. A lot of people actually not being near family, whereas if they were back home, they would have been. Yeah. All of these things account to, when you look at a holistic picture and you look at every factor, so many things change when you're no longer in your environment, when you're no longer surrounded by people who understand you, when you're thrown in a foreign situation. You know, if even language barriers as well, when going to appointments. It's all a big part of it.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to imagine how outside that can feel. I imagine sort of in a UK hospital must be a very foreign environment for somebody who's used to a very different culture. And the thought of going there at all must be quite a challenge, I can believe. But, it's interesting what you say there about the lifestyle, about the style of eating and all the rest of it, is that it can be so different. And I mean, the sun, of course, is another factor, isn't it? I think that, you know, we all, everybody in the UK, as is well known, none of us have enough vitamin D because we don't have any sun here. And when we do, we don't spend enough time in it. But of course, it's compounded for black people, isn't it? That actually they're built for loads of sun, and then we get you know, a paltry amount in the UK. And you know, I assume that the vitamin D levels, which is such a crucial thing for cancer prevention, are actually, you know, right through the bottom, I'm guessing. But is that known?
That's the vitamin D levels being lower is definitely a known thing amongst people, amongst black people. I know even myself with my own situation, that's been something. And all they do is give you supplements, and a supplement cannot do as good as what the actual sun can do.
No.
You know what I mean? So it's
so it is an issue. It's something that, you know, it should be headline, basically. Anybody who's got dark skin should know that it's something to watch out for, just from a prevention point of view, shouldn't they? If they're going to move to a place where we don't have a lot of sun, let's face it, that is something that everybody needs to know. Anyway, they're not very hot on it, even for the rest of the population, you know, where everybody's deficient in vitamin D, but you try and get some help on it, and, you know, they won't even test your levels for you. So it's just not taken very seriously, unfortunately.
I think another thing as well is also generationally as well, things have changed from the way how we do things, and taken on maybe other cultures and stuff like that, because of, like I said again, we're not in our original settings and stuff. So even a lot of people not knowing about how important the sun is for us, you know, you knowing that is probably like a lot of people in our community don't know the importance of that. But yeah, when you go on holiday, you feel so good because you're getting charged up by that sun.
Right. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and the other thing that comes to my mind is that, okay, we've our culture here has grown up with the rise of kind of junk food and all the rest of it. And at the same time as it's got worse and worse, you know, industrial food, there's also been a level of learning how to get around industrial food, how to still get good nutrition. You know, a certain sector of the population has to get savvier and savvier at finding good food and telling the difference between stuff that looks good or is made out to be good, has been greenwashed, and stuff that actually is good. Now, that's a kind of thing it's grown up over time. And I can imagine that if you arrive here fresh from a completely different culture, differentiating between, you know, absolute rubbish and good food, it must be hard. And so the junk food is actually made to appeal to the senses and to be addictive. So if you haven't got your sort of feelers out, knowing what junk food is and how bad it is for you, I assume that, you know, you could very easily just arrive here and plunge into thinking, oh, this is all great stuff, and suffer the consequences. Is that a factor, do you think?
I think that a lot of the people, when they did come over, they did actually bring a lot of food from back home over here that they could plant and grow.
Right.
But a lot of those foods aren't going to be as nutrient dense as they would be if they were grown in such nutrient dense environments.
Right.
Now, when it comes to the junk food and stuff, definitely further down the line, generationally, you also got to look at a lot of the areas where cancer is rife, and then look at how many junk foods are just placed there on the high streets.
Absolutely.
And basically into our minds, into the, you know, what we see on TV, all of these things, all has a factor. Like, even if we wanted to, it's like the cheaper option ends up being the junk food, unless you know where to go and get cheaper foods. But that knowledge isn't generally shared amongst people. It's not generally shared. So it's a hard one.
Yeah, it is a hard one. And, you know, and of course, where we've all been enjoying the horrors of junk food for years here, people who come from a traditional culture have had a much better diet for much more recently than we have, you know, and so it's quite a shock to go from a very traditional diet, which is, I say, they're very often excellent and they're very suited to the people because it's stuff that comes locally, you know, it's completely suited to their bodies, to then suddenly arrive with a load of kind of tinned and microwave stuff. It is a bit of a shock to the body, I think.
Yeah, and I even think from a personal perspective, like, even more than the food sometimes, like, the mind can, like I said again, the emotional distress and the things right. that people are going through can play such a huge factor. I think it's so important to look at every aspect and not even just pin things to one thing because of there's many women that we have who have had breast cancer and all of that, and they've been avid gym goers. There have been people who have eaten a healthy lifestyle, and, you know, it still happens. Like, there's so many factors within our environment that can cause this stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, we've already talked about a lot of different things there, and the stresses of being in a different culture where everything's different and all the rest. But, of course, on top of all that, you've then got the actual discrimination that's going on, which is a horrible thing to live with, where, you know, you're actually sort of not welcome in a certain way. You know, it's like, you know, who are you to be here kind of attitude, which, of course, that creates a constant stress. Like probably every time you step outside your door, there's a potential of feeling unwelcome, which it can happen to anybody, that kind of thing, but it's certainly far more likely to happen to people of colour, to the BAME community, as we all know. You know, that extra stress is much more likely, and it's only just beginning to be addressed, really, in any kind of serious way. But I'm glad to say it is, but, I mean, it's long, long, long overdue, of course.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Even just the comments of the name Black Women Rising and people kind of being upset with that, which is why that event was put on, just because of the negative comments that got put forward just for it saying Black Women Rising or focusing on this area. But I think the thing that we always try to push out is we wouldn't be doing this if it was already being done in the mainstream. Right. There wouldn't even be a need for it. So for us to be doing so well, for our charity to be growing, there must be a need for it.
Right.
So,
yeah. Fair enough. That's right. So, another area which is must be of interest to people who are looking into the differences between the outcomes for people who, from the BAME community and everybody else, the fact they're having these poorer results, must be the potential for there to be genetic variations. Is that something that you know anything about? Is it something that is a reality, or there's any evidence behind?
I have not seen any evidence regarding our genes being something that makes it more likely for us to have cancer. I haven't personally seen anything to do with that. So I wouldn't be able to say because I haven't seen it personally. But also, what I can say is in the hospitals, sometimes the treatment that we get, just in terms of how we are treated by staff, can actually be very standoffish. And one of the things which I can say is that for some reason there's this thing within the medical system where they think that Black people have a higher pain tolerance.
Really?
And sometimes they don't get this. It's very prevalent within when it comes to Black women who are pregnant, but it also is to do with anything that Black people go through, thinking that we somehow have a higher pain tolerance. And I'm not quite sure where this stigma has come from, but that is something.
Wow, sounds like sort of some incredibly deep cultural conditioning over hundreds of years to me. I mean, you know, extraordinary idea that would actually be the case. So that presumably has come from some piece of research that somebody's done to find that out.
Yeah, and because of that, people, you know, they may not get the right pain medication or the right treatment if they're not acting a certain way to get something, because of there's this stigma that we have this higher pain threshold. So
interesting. So so these are issues about access to good treatment. I mean, there are challenges for everybody in this, I have to say. That's what I'm talking about this show all the time. But obviously, yeah, it sounds like there's an extra layer there that you're talking about, which is added into all that, a bit like the extra layer of feeling unwelcome, maybe, when you're outside your front door. So the other area, which, of course, you know a lot about, and I'm here all the time, is integrative medicine, or the potential of integrative medicine to help people. And I'm going to guess that actually this is more accessible to other people than it is to the BAME community. Is that right?
As far as I know, yes, because I feel like a lot of people aren't actually told the things that are on offer to them as well, even if that is at their appointments or if it is in the general community, because you can actually get a lot of these alternative things from the NHS as well, like the acupuncture and stuff like that. And a lot of people don't know about these things or aren't told about these things. One of the things that we do as our charity is, like, we provide, like, pamper day events and things to kind of just, like, release stress and stuff like that.
Right. But, well, I think, you know, it's a general problem, of course, that people aren't told about integrative medicine yet. It's still not happening, really. But it requires some people to be standing up and shouting about it. And I think the thing that you mentioned earlier is a very important factor, which is that you need to see somebody you identify with standing up and shouting about it. It's not good enough. If I do it, it's okay, but it's not necessarily the same as somebody from the black community telling the black people, hey, there's lots of resources out there you could be using to help yourself. That's what it really needs, in a way. People need to identify with the person who's telling them, well, if they can do it, I can do it. You know, that kind of relatedness about it. And so hence how important the Leanne Perro Foundation is from that point of view. You're actually telling people. So is that part of your message about the resources that are out there outside of orthodox medicine?
As a charity, we're not really allowed to talk about, like, the things outside of, like, the medications and stuff like that. So alternative medicine, I myself share my stories, but within the charity, I'm not allowed to push upon the things that I've gone through onto, obviously, the ladies within the charity. I can't push them to go one way or another.
Right.
All I can do is share my personal journey and do it that way. I can't be seen to be pushing people to another way. So within the charity, that's something I can do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't do that, I have to say, even though that's what we're on all the time. That's not really our mission. Our mission is to make people aware of what's out there. And to help them decide what they want to do and help them to do that. So, yeah, we don't see our job as to persuade anybody to do or not to do anything. It's a very personal choice, I think, cancer treatment.
Yeah.
And what is a success to one person won't work for somebody else. And it's quite important that people do find their own way, I'd say. Well, very important they find their own way.
Definitely. I think what we do is say how unique the journey is and how important it is for a person to make a decision on their own and not be persuaded by, like, I don't know, not be persuaded by a story of someone who's gone through chemo, a story of someone who's gone through the alternative, to be able to weigh out the odds and see what's best for them.
Right.
So, you know.
Right.
Basically, like what you just said, but yeah.
But out of interest, though, obviously, Yes to Life, we're setting up to be as big a resource as we can possibly manage for people with cancer to find out about stuff. You know, we've got all the directory on our website. We've got shows like this where we're talking about the stuff. You know, we're doing whatever we can to raise awareness. We're having public events which people can come to. Would we be seen as a resource in the BAME community in the same way as we are within the rest of society?
I think, yeah, because of something like this could be something which could be, like, put on, like, a directory or something, if someone was interested in that, do go to them. But then the question also would be, maybe have you got people within your company, within your workshops, within the things you put out there, who are reflective of the people that we have? So, like, for instance, have you got Black people who are giving workshops and stuff like that? Are you reflecting in, like, your social media, like, all of these different things? Are you diversifying your stuff? Because when people see someone who looks like them, they're usually more open to then go and try something out.
Yeah,
well, I agree. That's what I would personally
say. You know, I would say the answer is a bit. I can't say more than that about us. We think about it, and we have diversified a bit, but it's actually, there's probably a long way to go. And I think it takes quite a bit of thought and effort to actually do it. It doesn't necessarily happen effortlessly, you know, or naturally.
Oh, 100%.
You have to actually do something about it. So, we definitely made steps in that direction, but I think we can do a lot more. So I wanted to ask about you and what you do in the Lee Ampero Foundation. What's your part in it all?
Okay, so I helped produce the Black Memorising series along with the host, Charlie, who was amazing. I also hosted and produced the second series of the Black Women Rising podcast.
Okay.
I'm a speaker for them as well. And also just kind of, I sit on the board just as like an assistant and that to the general manager and Leanne and stuff like that. So, yeah.
And how long have you been working with the foundation now?
So I actually started off as a volunteer from when the foundation first began in 2017. Yeah, and then I ended up when the foundation was able to, like, I guess, grow, because we recently grown into like a mini team and we have more things that we offer. I then kind of got more roles. So, for instance, we now have a Black Women Rising support group, a Stage 4 Cancer support group, a Black Girl Rising support group, which I help to facilitate once a month, and a Black Men Rising support group. So we've grown in support groups a lot.
That's right. Yeah. It's a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. Really good. I think they're so valuable, this type of work. I mean, we've had a program called Wigwam for a number of years, and it's had a few local support groups. But since COVID, we really put some muscle behind it and expanded the whole thing, you know, got it online. And we've got online support groups as well as real world ones now. And lots of sharing of great information going on. And, you know, the feedback that people express about the value of having that kind of support is enormous. You know, it means such a lot to people to find other people on their wavelength who are interested in what they're interested in, who understand the issues they're up against. It's so important.
Yes. Oh, another thing is, I was also a writer in the magazine that we launched last October.
Right.
And that's gone into a lot of hospitals and gone to a lot of people who are going through cancer.
Fantastic.
And we just had loads of stuff in there about lifestyle and support and a few case studies and stuff.
Excellent.
A great resource as well for anyone who does want to know more information about the brain community and stuff like that going through cancers.
Yeah.
Can be purchased on the website.
And so, what's the name of the magazine?
Black Women Rising.
It's actually called Black Women Rising. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, that's a great resource. And is it online as well?
No, so the magazine's only in hard copy, but it can be purchased online, but it's only a shipping fee that you pay for. You don't pay for that. Your magazine, just the shipping fee.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, so we're coming to the end. I wanted to bring it back to where we started with your story, and I just wanted maybe you tell us how the issues that we've been talking about today, how they impacted on you personally, your diagnosis, your treatment, your recovery, and indeed are they impacting on you in some way today?
Okay. So for me, I was so young when I was diagnosed, and it made me feel like I didn't know a lot of the things that were going on at the time when I was diagnosed and how I was being impacted. I never went to any support groups except for one or two that was within the hospital. And it wasn't until Black Women Rising started their support group that I actually went to a proper support group. And it was the feeling of a sisterhood when I was able to share my story with people who understood me, hearing stories about how women, the wigs they were offered didn't match their hair. And I was like, oh my gosh, like me too. Like when you hear all of these stories and you're like, me too, and you realize it wasn't just me, it can be a very emotionally healing place and space to be in. So for me, just being able to be around other women who look like me, be able to support them as well within the support group, be able to share and feel comfortable, it's been definitely a life-changing thing, because I feel like it's helped me open up to another level about sharing my journey and what I've been through. So it's definitely been an integral part of my healing.
Mm.
And even though it was so many years after I've been free of it, it still made such a huge impact. So yeah, it's been amazing just working with the charity as well.
Right. And are there any issues you feel are affecting you still today, that frustrate you, that you wish were not as they are? I'm talking about particularly in relation to being part of the BAME community.
I will probably say since being with Black Women Rising, I have seen like more media stuff, but just the stuff that they've done. But I still feel like there is a lack of us within the media, except for maybe the one or two like token Black people you'll see as something going a photograph. You just see the one there on the end. Like, I still see it as a huge issue. Mm. And even the social media thing, I say that affects me because of many people who have shared my story, and you do actually notice, you notice the difference in how people react to Black people when it's shared on a page which is probably predominantly white followers. You do notice that there's a big difference in the reaction that they get compared to when it's someone else who's posted. So that can be actually quite mentally, it can actually get to your head if you allow it to. Yeah. So I think those are the main things, just like getting more diversity out there still. Like, we've done a great job already, but still more needs to be done.
Yeah.
Like, I noticed when the whole Black Lives Matter thing happened, a lot of people were jumping on the bandwagon, like, yeah, let's get more Black people into the things. And then I felt like it just died down. Like, it should have been a thing that carried on. It shouldn't have just been a moment of, oh, quick, because this is what's in the media, this is what's hot at the moment. It should have been something where people was like, yes, we need diversity all the time, you know.
Mm.
So I think that's the main thing.
I know that in any situation you have where there's kind of somebody who's shortchanged in relation to the community they're in, there you have this situation which is, seems very unjust, where the most of the community say, well, what's the problem? That's where what their stance is. They don't see the problem, do they? They don't experience it, and they don't see it. And actually, they unwittingly, most of them, perpetuate it as a result.
Yeah.
And therefore, all the energy for change has to come from the people who are getting the bad deal. And they think, well, why do I have to do it all? You know, but it's the nature of the beast. That's, it seems it's always like that, unfortunately. And as you said, you have to sort of shout about it, really, basically, in order to bring about change. You have to say, hey, there is a problem, wake up. And you're clearly doing that anyway. And it's a bit, it's a grueling journey in some ways, and it can be thankless at times. And it's not necessarily well received. It's kind of like, to people who don't see a problem, you don't see why those people are making such a fuss. Well, you know, and so... You know, it's not necessarily welcome, but All I can say is I think in society generally there, you know, there are more ears listening than there were quite a short time ago. It's changed quite a bit.
And so
that must be heartening for you. It's a bit like I feel about integrated medicine. There's some more people listening than there used to be, you know, and that's really inspiring and makes me want to put my foot on the gas. So that's great. So I'm very pleased that it is going that way, and let's hope this is something that's just some distant memory soon.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I just want to say that I share your love for integrative medicine. Like,
I know.
Literally, I just wanted to say that because of...
Yeah.
I think the COVID thing has really changed things up because of where people was in the house more.
Yeah.
The more people were awakening and realizing certain things. So it's... is that although maybe it's been not a great time, in other ways it's been a brilliant time to help other things grow and have an opportunity.
It's been quite a leg up for integrated medicine, I think. Unwittingly, yes.
Yes.
Sort of a silver lining.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, look, we're out of time, Charlotte. It's been a really lovely talk.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming on and telling us all about Liam Parrow.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me on. All right, bye.
Bye. So great to be reminded of Charlotte's incredible story and her determination and courage in finding a way through for herself. She's a brilliant role model for the Leanne Perrow Foundation for sure. I'm currently in training to raise £25,000 for Yes to Life with a 70th birthday coast-to-coast ride, Land's End to the eastern tip of Kent, staying off-road as far as possible. 12 days in the saddle and a total climb of substantially more than the height of Everest. What was I thinking? Please help me make all the pain worthwhile by supporting me in reaching my fundraising target and helping to keep Yes to Life going, pushing forward integrative medicine in these extremely challenging times for charity fundraising. To support me, just go to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and scroll down to the news item entitled Robin's Senior Struggle. Thanks for listening today. Please join me again next week for another Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.